This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Alan Farmer with you on today's episode of Afternoons. We were getting expert advice and hearing real life stories, chatting with Dr. Bissi and a couple of expats about repatriation. How do you feel about leaving the UAE? We're hearing from people who have been there and done it, what they wish they'd known before they pack their bags. We were also discussing Autism Awareness Month with three experts in the studio. We had a mum, we had the founder of a support group for autistic girls, and also a speech and language therapist, talking about some of the common myths and misconceptions and how maybe the world needs to change. These children don't need to be fixed. And in Pets and Vets, Dr. Manas on hand as we talked everything from fussy cats to little hamsters. It's a busy one today. Today we are exploring the intricate and sometimes complicated journey of repatriation. So returning to someone's home country after an extended period abroad. And it might sound sometimes like a bit of a homecoming filled with joy and familiarity, but it can also bring some psychological challenges, from identity crises to coping with cultural adjustments, the sheer practicalities. To shed light on this topic, we're going to be joined by Dr. Bissi Lanyon, a clinical psychologist and adult specialist at Sage Clinics. And we're speaking to two expats who have relocated. What do they wish they had known? We are going to be unravelling some of the psychological nuances of repatriation and talking about how to navigate its challenges as well. Dr. Bissi joining us live in the studio. We're going to be chatting with her in a minute, because first joining us on Teams from the UK is Dima. She lived in Dubai for 20 years and then moved to the UK with her husband and two sons in 2019, which I would say, thinking about the last few years, Dima, an interesting time to be moving anywhere in the world. I wanted to ask you, first of all, what were your expectations before moving to the UK?
Thank you, Helen, and hello, everyone. Well, for us, it was really about, you know, experiencing something a little bit different. I'd been in Dubai for about 20 years, David, for about maybe 11 in the region. The boys were born there. And our expectation was that, you know, we would be closer to one part of our family. There would be more opportunity, a lot more greenery, and just a different, you know, pace, different way of life. And more really about what the boys would be able to do in comparison to what we could offer them in Dubai.
Now, I think there's kind of two things to be kind of addressing about this. One is the practical side, and one, I guess, is the emotional side. And I guess, as you said, you had family and friends there, and it was a bit of a softer landing, I guess, in that respect. But what about that emotional side? How did you prepare for leaving the UAE, and how did it feel when you got to the other side on that part?
Leaving the UAE was not an easy decision, and it took us a long time to come to terms with that. And I think it took us about a year while we were actually building towards leaving. What do we need to do? Mm-hmm. The practicality of it. What memories did we want to take with us? Who did we really, really want to make sure that we spend time with before we go? And the other side was, you know, being closer to another side of our life, which was the UK friends, the UK family. By the time we left, we were ready to go. We were, you know, all set. We had done what we needed to do, and we were ready for that next chapter. Of course, that was in July 2019, and it was great. And then, of course, you know what happened with the world a few months after that. So that was a little bit of a spanner in the works, but it wasn't, at no point did we think, gosh, we shouldn't have left, or gosh, if we could do it over.
Mm-hmm. What do you wish you had known? What do you wish you'd been more prepared for about moving to the UK?
So as I am not a British national, it was, for me, it was the ease of living in Dubai, or the Middle East, really. The distance, even though we used to complain about how far it was to get anywhere, but actually when you're commuting from city to city, that is a different take on working life. I think the thing that I had wish I had known was probably how we had it easier in terms of how you make friends, how you socialize, how you can get doctor's appointments really easily, how you can buy most things over the counter. Mm-hmm. Those are not the things that you naturally find out except when you really need them.
Yeah, the day-to-day.
When you are living abroad.
The trains, the appointments and all that stuff. So
I didn't even really care about the weather so much. It was just an exciting novelty, right? You had to leave with something to cover your head or protect you from the rain.
Bad weather. It's just bad clothes. I wanted to ask you, lastly, Dima, what advice would you give to anyone? And we are coming to that time of year where families might be moving on at the end of the school term, so coming onto July, and now is the time where they're starting to, you know, sell things or think about, you know, finding a new family for their nanny and all those kind of practical side, but also, as you say, dealing with the emotional side of saying goodbyes and I guess kind of grieving the life that they might have in Dubai. What advice would you give to anyone who might be packing their bags soon?
I would say give yourself time to do it properly. Don't leave yourself to the last minute in terms of thinking, a rush, because I think the best thing that you can do is leave knowing that you are comfortable and you are relaxed about leaving. Mm-hmm. So, you know, don't move out the day before you travel. Don't cancel Diwa the day after you leave, you know, things like that, the practicalities. And I would say probably if you're packing up your house, give yourselves a few days after you leave your home to maybe stay with friends or in a hotel or something so that you do have a relaxed exit, if you will.
Thank you so much for sharing your experiences. I think it's really lovely to hear someone who's, you know, kind of been there, done it, had to buy a T-shirt the other side, you know, all that kind of stuff. And thank you so, so much. I'm really excited to hear what the future holds. And we're going to be hearing all sorts of different perspectives over the course of the afternoon. Dima joining us there from the UK on Teams. We're going to be speaking next to Dr. Bissy. She is a clinical psychologist and talking more about some of the psychological nuances of relocating. This hour, we are unravelling the psychological nuances of repatriation, discovering some effective ways to navigate its challenges too. Joining us from Sage Clinics, we've got Dr. Bissy, clinical psychologist and adult specialist. And it is the time of year, Doctor, where people are thinking about it. Maybe they've already got, you know, they're thinking about the pet relocation and the selling the furniture. And I feel like we often really take care of that practical side, but maybe don't emotionally prepare ourselves to relocate, especially to our quote unquote home country. Because, it's interesting, I had some friends move back a few years ago and they ended up having couples counselling before they moved. And this counsellor said to them, you need to grieve for your lives in Dubai. You even need to an extent to grieve for your relationship here because it's going to be completely different when you move. And I wondered if you would do such a thing, if you've had couples or individuals come to you before moving countries.
Yes. Thanks for having me. First of all, I think that when people are moving back to their home country, they go with that expectation that it's my home country. I'll be able to just slot myself in and fit in and everything would be okay. And I think that one thing that people struggle to maybe identify during that transitional period is that you're moving somewhere that may have changed, but also whilst you've been here, you have changed. So you're not, in fact, slotting back in. Mm-hmm. So then we see that kind of like tension between who I am now here in Dubai versus who I'm going to be when I get back. And like you said, relationships don't exist in the same format here than they do back home.
Question here from Jay saying, how about if one partner is ready to leave and the other isn't? That's a very interesting question because I actually think that probably happens more than we realise. Yeah. It must be quite rare for, you know, if you're talking about a couple to go, I'm ready to leave too. Yeah. I've got a great opportunity. I've also got a great opportunity. Happy days. Let's go. Because someone might be more happy here than their partner. How can you help reconcile with that?
Yeah, that's really difficult because the partner that doesn't want to go back might start to develop a bit of resentment towards that partner, which might make adjusting difficult and settling in difficult.
So in that kind of, well, you said we should move back.
Absolutely.
This is miserable.
Exactly. But, now we're here. I'm unhappy or things aren't working.
Oh, look, proving my point again and again. So what can you do to perhaps offset that or prepare to get on the same page? Anything that can work?
I think before you go, having those kind of honest conversations with your partner that I really don't want to go back, but I'm doing this because we're a team. And as a team, we work together. And sometimes someone might have to compromise a little bit more than the other. Mm-hmm. These are the ways that I would like for you to show up for me when we move back. Like if you're someone that maybe has to go into a new industry, how are you going to support me in developing these skills? Are you going to help me with my interview? Sorry, excuse me. Are you going to help me with my interviewing skills? Mm-hmm. What does making friends look like for us? Especially if maybe one of the partners, they haven't lived in that country before.
Which actually is a really good point when you think about, you know, how many kind of cross-cultural marriages there might be here. I mean, Dima's saying there that she's not a British passport holder, but her husband is. So, that, you know, she's basically moved to his home turf and, you know, already feeling on the kind of the back foot. One of my pet peeves is when people decide to leave Dubai and then they get really, really negative about it before they leave.
About Dubai?
Yeah. And they're like, oh, you know, we're on the 30-day countdown. Oh, it's Dubai exit, it's Dexit. I'm like, we hate... Totally, but it's so offensive to people around them. We had this a few years ago and I'm like, just leave. Just leave, because all you're doing is making us feel bad about our decision to stay. If you're complaining about X, Y, Z, I just don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
And that was quite challenging because that was the husband, and the wife actually really didn't want to go. Lots of questions coming in on this and some comments as well. Message here saying, we're back after two miserable years. It was like moving to a foreign country. Family wasn't around as much as we'd hoped. Yeah. Everyone was stressed. The kids couldn't settle. We're very fortunate we've had the chance to return to Dubai. Mm-hmm. We've had a question about managing expectations, saying we're both going to be working. We're leaving Dubai after 9 years of having a nanny, anticipating some disagreements about running the house. What can we do now? So any questions? We'd love to hear from you. We're also going to be hearing after 5:30 from Kaya, who left the UAE for the UK and, spoiler alert, is back. Dr. Bissi Lanyan is in the studio, clinical psychologist and adult specialist from Sage Clinics, and we're exploring repatriation, that process of returning to someone's home country after maybe an extended period abroad. And it is that time of the year where people start, and I've seen it on the Facebook groups, selling furniture, we're moving back home, we need to find a new family for our nanny, you know, all of these changes. And we touched on a couple of things there earlier, which was about expectations, that I am going to, you know, quote unquote, slot back into my family life. You know, we've had a message here saying, you know, we thought our family was going to be around more, you know, that there'd be more support there. We had a message asking about what happens if one partner is ready to move and the other isn't. We had an anonymous message. Someone's choosing to leave their name off, and that's absolutely fine, saying, keen to hear from your doctor about a family moving back. We're both going to be working, and after 9 years with a nanny, I'm anticipating some disagreements about running the house. What can we do now to manage expectations? We're leaving in August. So some big chats, I think, in a lot of families. But that's a very kind of practical thing, is we've had someone to be taking care of the laundry and the floors and, you know, some childcare as well, perhaps. Making sure you're on that same page as well.
Absolutely. And having conversations of what does this change in our family, what does it look like? What kind of things will I be expecting you to do? What things am I comfortable doing? And also it depends on the age of the children, because you can, in a fun way, get them involved in things like chores. That way you're teaching them responsibility. You're teaching them how to be independent. You're teaching them how to help and care and think about others. So this can be a discussion that you have with your partner, but then also a discussion that you bring your children in on as well. So they're also feeling like they are active participants in this transition and this change.
That's interesting, because I think a lot will depend on the age of the children as well, because there can be resistance, there can be excitement about going back. 40010, if you want to have your say in this, you're also more than welcome to pick up the phone, have a chat. And let's hear from Kaya now. Let's hear her story.
Hi, Han. So a quick voice note about the struggles of moving back to our home country, which is the UK. although our home country definitely feels like Dubai, given the kids are all born there, I think we had based our summer holiday experiences on what life would be like permanently in the UK, which is very different. Obviously, in the summer, the weather is a bit better and people are around more. I think the weather was a big factor in moving back and struggling. Also, we moved back to a small village, and having lived in a cosmopolitan city, that again was a bit of a shock to the system. We missed the multicultural element and the sort of ease of life in Dubai, that everything is available very easily and quickly. Also found that in Dubai, it is really a anything is possible kind of place, whereas everything in the UK seemed to come with obstacles and barriers. I mean, don't get me wrong, there were good parts. It was nice to be with family, but in terms of quality of life and the sort of exposure to a modern world that we want our children to have, I think we are very, very grateful to be back in Dubai. Also, actually, there's this misconception that Dubai is really expensive compared with the UK. And yes, we may have a healthcare system there that's available to everyone for free, but that is majorly flawed. I mean, on the occasion that we had to take our children to hospital, we waited hours and hours, and it was completely horrendous, the whole experience. Also, I would say it's not that much cheaper to live there, and the tax is obviously a massive factor. So yeah, I would just consider all these things before thinking the grass is greener, because it certainly isn't.
Kai there talking about her experiences, and I've spoken to friends who have moved back and some have stayed, and the friendship piece I think has been a bit surprising as well, because you might be lucky enough to have friends in the place that you're moving back to, but Dubai is a very welcoming, I think for the most part, expat city, where you can be invited to brunch by colleagues, and the next weekend you could be going to the beach with those people, or, you know, going camping and all that kind of stuff. What about this idea of being isolated or lonely when you do choose to move back, Dr. Bissi?
Yeah, and that is in some ways like a harsh reality, that when you do move back, you might not connect with the people that you did in the same way. Mm-hmm. One of the main reasons could be that actually now living in somewhere like Dubai that is so diverse, so rich in culture and languages, is that your mind becomes a bit more broad. Your perspective is different. And sometimes you might be shocked or might be surprised at some of the views that your friends hold, which maybe you used to hold and you no longer hold. So even kind of integrating back in those circles is uncomfortable, and it's not something that you necessarily want to do. Mm-hmm. And then another thing about Dubai is that most of us are expats. Most of us have moved here. Some have moved with family, some have moved and they know a few people here already. But the reality is that we haven't moved with our entire system. And with that comes this desire to connect. So people are more open-minded, people are more willing. Whereas back home, people have more established ways of living in terms of, I grew up in this city, I was born in this city, I was born in this town, my mum was born in this town, I went to this primary school, this secondary school, this university. And people have their way of doing things.
Totally.
So there isn't like an incentive of making new friends or even being open-minded to welcome a friend back into to the social circle.
Yeah, I had one friend who was like, I've taken the dog to the school gates hoping that other dog people will talk to us, and no one's interested. Yeah. We'd love to get your take on this, guys. Up next, I know we feel like we have been a bit Debbie Downer about relocating, so we are going to talk about what the opportunities can be as well. I've had a message from Graham saying, we're leaving Dubai at the end of the summer term. Kids are 7 and 5, born here. They love going back to the UK on holidays, but don't seem to grasp they'll be at school. It's not just farm visits and being at grandparents. Any tips to explain the reality? We'd love to help you out. We're talking repatriation on the show today. Some really fascinating insights and questions coming in on the text line and indeed the phone line. Candice joining us on the phone now. What's your take on this, Candice? How would you feel about leaving the UAE?
Hi, Helen. Lovely to talk to you.
And you.
So I've actually lived in the Middle East pretty much my whole life, which is now more than 40 years. Born and brought up over here. And my parents were here, you know, even before I got here. So for them, it's like they were here their whole lives. They've literally seen the city grow and, you know, change all around them. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as they hit 60, 65, they've had to go back now because they're no longer working. It's retirement and there's no concept of retirement here. So for them, going back was insane. Like when they went back to India, they couldn't fit in. They were constantly trying to just keep coming back on holiday just to stay here. And sometimes looking at them, it's something that worries me that, you know, what will happen when I turn 60 and when I have to go back, you know, because there's no concept of a retirement in UAE. So if that ever does happen, that would be wonderful. But it is something that, you know, weighs on your mind, like what next from Dubai?
What's next? I think it's I think that speaks to a really interesting point about how, you know, grateful we can be to have spent some time here, but also learning from their experiences. Candice, thank you so much. It's not something you need to worry about for a while. And I really hope your parents have some lovely holidays here in the meantime. We've also had a question here, no name on this one. Dr. Bissy's with us today from Sage Clinic saying, we haven't told friends yet, but a question for the doctor. Any advice on how to prep a tween for returning to home country? Having made super special group of friends here who are as everything, and now having to start again in a community where friendships already like to be formed, and he'll be the newbie trying to fit in, especially when he's a worldly Dubai kid going home to an unworldly community. Thank you.
Yeah, that's tricky. Yeah, because being at that age is quite sensitive. You're developing, your sense of identity starting to form. I think that on a practical level, as parents, speaking to your child and hearing what some of their concerns are. And if the child wants to share things outside of the family, then therapy would be a very good space to explore that. But also reminding your child of how they have successfully transitioned in the past. So from like nursery into primary school and maybe
sports clubs,
exactly. And they've got those skills which are transferable. And even thinking about going into the school, like having an open day or visiting the school first before the child actually starts, and maybe speaking to their new class teacher to set up some sort of like buddy system to help your child integrate, figure out where the toilets are, what time is lunch, playground, and just to have a buddy to help them.
Softer landing.
Absolutely.
What about the framing of the delivery of the news, Dr. Bissy, in terms of, right, we're going to sit down, we've got something big to tell you, we're leaving the country, and it maybe being a kind of earth-shattering revelation versus we've had a really exciting opportunity, this is where we're going to be. Does the tone make a difference with kids and tweens?
The tone makes a difference, and also the timing. Mm-hmm. It's not advisable to kind of have this kind of discussion after a really hard day
or exam period or something.
Exactly.
It's interesting you mentioned there about therapy, because I feel like, you know, the world is getting a bit more proactive about this. And, you know, instead of going when times are in crisis, in terms of offering a bit more of resilience and support, because we all really need someone to talk to that hasn't got a vested interest, that hasn't got an agenda. And, you know, I've seen it with my own 9-year-old, for her to have someone to talk to. And it's not official therapy session. It's a kind of it's a different format. It's really lovely for her to feel validated.
Absolutely.
And not cut off and not, well, you don't need to worry about that, which I definitely as a parent have a tendency to do. So is there anyone at Sage that you'd recommend that works with adolescents and kids in particular?
Yes. So we have Dr. Ramina, and she's absolutely amazing with adolescents. We also have Dr. Wafa, who's absolutely amazing with the adolescents as well. And I think that for both of them, what they really promote is the young people having a space to actually share their concerns. And like you said, without cutting off, validating, normalizing, but also drawing on their strengths and thinking about what innate qualities do they have that has enabled them to do well in other areas, and how can you continue to exhibit those qualities when you move back home or when you move away from Dubai.
Dr. Bissy, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. And thank you to everyone who joined the conversation. It's definitely something we're going to revisit in the future, especially as we, of course, get closer to when people are packing their bags. In the meantime, if you want details of Dr. Bissy and Sage, you can just send me the word doc. We'll make it super easy on 4001. And thank you for all of the messages. One just come in from Julie now saying, I moved two of my daughters, aged 12 and 16, from London to Kuwait. It was hard, very hard, but all three of my daughters said it was the best thing that we ever did.
We are marking World Autism Day today with a hat trick of brilliant contributors. In studio, we've got Heidi Jones. She's a health coach. She's a mum to Hannah, who has autism. She's also set up a support group for parents of girls in particular with autism in the UAE. Annabelle Whitcomb is with us today. She's a speech and language therapist for Insight Psychology, a clinic that comes up time and time again in terms of being really well regarded for diagnosis, but also support of a whole range of issues. And we've got mum of three, Yasmin Kerry, in the studio. Her son, Ellis, is 4.5. We're going to be talking about her experiences so far. So I'm delighted to have such a great panel in the studio. I'd love to kind of go around and hear a little bit more about each of you. And I guess your mission with what you do, whether that is on social media or in a professional capacity. Heidi, could we start with you? Where did it begin for you, your interest, your passion in this area?
Yeah, I really felt like I needed to just step up and advocate for my daughter. Over the years, it's gradually just built and built. And I think it's through this element of, like, I've had to build resilience to be able to kind of be there and be the mum that she needs. So I was in groups before, and they're fantastic and they provide loads of great information. But what I was finding was that with Hannah's needs as an autistic girl, there was just that kind of lack of understanding.
A bit of a gap.
Yeah, there was a bit of a gap. There was a lack of understanding or kind of relatability.
Interesting.
And so I thought, you know what, I have a break. And then I decided to set up my own club.
Love the attitude. If it's not there, I'm going to create it. I do want to get into that kind of difference in presentation of girls and boys kind of more in depth. But for now, your daughter's coming up to 5, is that right?
She's five. Yeah,
okay.
She's 5.
So I want to hear a little bit about the diagnosis process as well. And Annabelle, as I said, you're a speech and language therapist.
Yeah.
Where did this begin in terms of your interest and what kind of issues are coming into clinic?
Yeah, I mean, I qualified way back in, 2014. And it was actually doing a little bit of volunteering work back in France. And I saw, you know, how children were using different communication methods like Makaton sign and high tech AAC. So that's alternative and augmentative communication. And I thought, wow, this is amazing, because communication is a human right. And a lot of our neurodivergent children, you know, are really struggling to mm-hmm. communicate. So it kind of went from there, and through different jobs that I've had, I kind of just sort of fell into autism, to be honest. I remember, you know, the first time I did intensive interaction, and, you know, I've worked with Hannah and Heidi for several years. It was a very weird experience. It was very, very difficult. But actually, we've kind of been on a bit of a journey together, Heidi and Hannah and Rob and I. And it's been wonderful watching her grow.
Amazing, I would imagine, and hugely rewarding.
Absolutely.
To see families come together and grow together through the tools you're able to offer. And are you happy to
take
questions if people want to send in messages to you,
Annabelle? Yeah, sure. Far away.
Yasmin, as I said, you're member three. You've got Ellis, who we're going to be talking about today, and he's 4?
He's 4.5.
Four and a half.
So he'll be 5 in June.
Tell us a little bit about your experiences so far. And I think you so beautifully explain on social media some of the challenges, some of your revelations and experiences. Would you mind giving us a little snapshot into motherhood to this point?
As you said, I'm a mum of three, so my eldest is neurotypical. And then when Ellis was around, even when he was a baby, I kind of had that, like, I don't know, mother's intuition, something was different. And I would be like singing nursery rhymes and, like, you know, trying to make him laugh. And sometimes he would, and then sometimes it would just be like a blank expression. And to me, that was like, oh, red flag. But everybody around, literally everyone around me was like, he's fine. Boys are lazy, blah, blah, blah. You know, that everybody says, like, boys are slower, boys are lazy, he'll get there. And, you know, physically, his motor skills are amazing. And then, like, speech just did not come. The behaviour was getting worse. It was, like, really, really challenging, actually. And then it took until he was, like, 2.5, 3 for me to actually accept it. I feel like it's part of it is, as a parent, you have to go through that process of, right, something is different and I need to act on it to help him, because hiding away is not going to help him. It's not going to help us. And it's accepting that is the hardest thing, actually. So, yeah, we've just been on this journey since he was about 3 years old of finally accepting his challenges and his differences, and then going through therapy. And, you know, we've seen so many people, and I talk about it all the time, like finding the right person for your child is really, really important as well.
And finding the right advocates for your child, as Heidi, I'm sure, will be talking about soon. Right,
yeah.
We've got lots to talk about. We've had questions coming in on 4001, and actually a couple of things I want to address from Adam, the OT, our conversation yesterday, about terminology, about, you know, does labelling matter? Does getting a diagnosis make a difference? Up next, what myths and misconceptions does our panel want to beat? Joining us in studio, we've got mum of three, Yasmin Carey. We've got Annabelle Whitcomb, who is a speech and language therapist from Insight Psychology. And Heidi Jones joining us. She's a health coach, is also mum to Hannah. And she has set up a support group for parents of girls in the UAE. And I wanted to ask you about myths and misconceptions. And I'm sure that whether you've had a diagnosis or you're just starting to do a bit of a deep dive into research, you must learn an awful lot awfully quickly. And Heidi, I wanted to ask you in terms of what myths, which misunderstandings, now that you've got the power of the microphone here on Dubai Eye, would you like to put to rest?
There's so many. Okay, so I'm going to start with when we say the word like autism, and I know everyone else in this room is talking on the same sort of wavelength here. So when it comes to Hannah being autistic, that's part of her identity. And so she's autistic and I can embrace that. She has a different way of thinking, a different way of looking out to the world. She doesn't have autism and it's not a condition that we have to look at fixing.
Fix.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big one that I've learned over the years. You know, when she first got highlighted at school, those terms of like red flags, I don't use at all when it comes to Hannah, because for me, the red flags are the environment. So over the years, what I've learned is it's nothing to do with the child. It's the child's environment that really impacts how they, you know, are able to cope and manage what's around them and what's happening.
That sounds like it's about a mindset around working with your child rather than working against what they might be labelled as.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Because I did... You know, when we first looked into diagnosis, Hannah was two. And you do get, like what Yasmin said, when they're that young, people around you say, that's too young. She might grow out of it. She might change, you know. And it wasn't the right time for us as a family to get a diagnosis, purely for the fact that it didn't make an impact in how we were going to be able to help her. Mm-hmm. So we didn't do it then. But I was really glad now. Looking back, I'm glad, because what I was able to do is spend 2 years learning more about special educational needs and what comes with being autistic. Now, there was always that and an ah, is she autistic? Again, she's a girl and there's not necessarily all the characteristics that you read about or you see. I didn't know any autistic girls. I've never been around any. So it was very much going on what I was reading and from the experts like Annabelle to kind of guide us in the right direction of what to learn. Mm-hmm. But through that, it just really helped me see, wow, everyone looks at the child as the one that's got the issue, when actually it's everything around her wasn't set up for her to thrive or succeed. And we, as the adults, have to adapt. Mm-hmm. She is not the one that is to adapt for the adult.
What I'm hearing here is you are obviously incredibly involved and engaged and educated. Like, and that's a real choice as a parent to do that, because
yeah.
I'm sure there are a lot of parents who are in maybe a bit of denial about diagnosis or what they're seeing from their child. And that must be really challenging for you as an expert, Annabelle, to come up against that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, we would never push a family into obtaining a diagnosis if that's not something that they're ready for. Mm-hmm. You know, but we might say, okay, we can notice some sensory differences with your child or attention differences. And you know, kind of starting those conversations usually leads parents to Google and they start looking up these things and they start piecing things together, because it's actually, I think, far more powerful for families when they can kind of get to that conclusion on their own. rather than being pushed into that.
How do you feel about that, Yasmin, in terms of, you know, you said you've spoken to many, many different experts from all different kind of disciplines and trainings. And I'm not saying everyone has an agenda, but a lot of people have a goal, you know, of saying this is an assessment and this is the goal that we're going to reach. But as a parent, you need to make, as Annabelle said, you know, your own decisions in your own time.
Yeah, so we've had experiences with all different clinics and experts and people telling us what we should and shouldn't do. And honestly, 9 times out of 10, they all differentiate in their advices. So as a parent on this journey at the beginning, it's really, really confusing. It's a lot. It's very overwhelming. And like, of course, we want to do the best for our children. Everybody wants that. And I do feel like some places here are commercially driven, whereas like in the UK you get a diagnosis and there's so many benefits to having a diagnosis. In the UK you get free support, you get, you know, you get put into a system where it's you know, you get escalated in the school system and there's things there that help you. There is a benefit to it, whereas here I haven't had Ellis diagnosed yet. Just as, not that I'm in denial of, I know I can see my child and every report that I've had done of him, it's written out and I'm like, yeah, I know that, I know that, I know this. I know my child more than anybody that sits with him for 20 minutes in a room. So for me to get an official diagnosis, I already know. And I was saying to the girls earlier before we came in, had I've had him diagnosed last year, it would be a different diagnosis to this year. It would probably be the same in the sense of like what his overall challenges are, but his abilities have changed within a year so much. Like we're getting small sentences, we've got finger pointing, we have got, he listens to and responds to his name, he can focus. Like the other day he painted eggs for Easter. That would not have happened last year. He would have just thrown the eggs and ran off, and you know, but he can sit for like 10-15 minutes and do an activity now. So had I have, you know, just rushed in and had all of these things, and it does affect your school process, because there are some schools that just cannot facilitate children with additional needs. There are some amazing schools here as well that have, you know, extra facilities, and we've been on such a journey with Ellis's schooling. Well, we can touch on that later.
We'll have a question about it.
Oh, do we? Yeah. So I speak about it a lot on socials, and I'm really open, because when we started this journey, I was really lost and I felt so alone. Like Heidi, you probably feel the same. Like Ellis is a boy, so I feel like this being on the spectrum is, oh, sorry, I'm saying it inverted commas, like more common in boys, but nobody really speaks about it in girls. And I'm on a WhatsApp group with some amazing mums. It's called Quirky Mum and Vino. So we all get together, you know, everybody chats. And a lot of those girls are in this, there's like teenage girls, and they're all talking about, you know, as you go through hormonal changes and you hit puberty, and what then if you can't process that, or the kids are struggling to deal with these changes in their body. And I always think Ellis's teeth are going to start falling out soon. Like, what is going to happen?
Yeah, when puberty kicks in.
Yeah, and just all these little changes. Like, he had an accident last week.
And this is the thing, it's going to be an ever-changing conversation, which is why support around you and the right experts must be so crucial. We are going to be delving into the role of support groups, because Heidi's there offering a huge amount of value to an awful lot of people here in the UAE. We've already had messages, some actually from yesterday's conversation with Adam the OT. We've had a couple of messages on social about speech delays. I love a busy studio, and I was really annoyed when I had to go next door and record something, because I could hear our three guests having what looked like a great chat. Hopefully they've saved some radio gold for you. In the studio, we've got Heidi Jones. She's a health coach. She's also a mum to Hannah. And she's also set up a support group for parents of autistic girls here in the UAE. We've got Annabelle Whitcomb with us today from Insight Psychology. She's a speech and language therapist. And mum of three, Yasmin Carey, there speaking so beautifully about four-year-old Ellis. And the huge progress he's made over the course of the last year. The text lines are open, and I've had a number of messages through social and earlier in the show as well. So is it okay if we go to the messages? Okay, right. We touched on this briefly, which is why I want to come back to it now. Willem saying, how much of an impact on school applications can having a formal autism diagnosis make? Yasmin, would you mind touching briefly, and I think that four is like, you know, it's the age where you've just been through it, especially having an older child.
Yeah.
You haven't got a kind of a formal diagnosis, but what kind of reception have you had from schools?
So we haven't. I'm very honest and open about Ellis. So when I have applied for schools or gone to see schools and done a tour, I've actually emailed and said, like, I would like to also speak to the inclusion team as well. Some schools here have amazing, amazing inclusion teams, by the way, like really, really helpful. And I always go in without the kids. I like to see the school, even with Mason, my eldest, who's neurotypical, I would always go in to see the school first. I don't want them to like get their hopes up, or and if I don't like it, mm-hmm. you know what it's like. So I go in, I speak to them, I'm really, really open. And they're like, the first thing they say is, have you had a diagnosis? And I'm like, no, I haven't. But I know my child and I can tell you exactly, you know, what he's like and what he's likely to be diagnosed with if he was to have one. Some schools actually require a diagnosis if your child is on the spectrum or they have additional challenges, because some schools won't actually accept children who have additional challenges. They would maybe have to have an LSA, which is a learning support assistant. So they would be, you know, like a shadow teacher just dedicated to them. You then have to pay for that as well. So you have to think about the financial implication of having a child on the spectrum and getting them into school and finding something that fits them. And I always say to my husband, when we were looking at schools for Ellis, I can't put him into a mainstream school. It's like putting my 8-year-old into a GCSE class. Yeah, he would be there, but he's not doing anything. He's never going to develop. He's just going to ponder around on his own. He's going to get frustrated. And, you know, it's not the right environment for him. So we actually found the perfect school for him, actually. Heidi, you explored it as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
I was going to say, Heidi, this must be a really hot topic in your group as well. I mean, if you want to give the school a shout out.
Can I?
Of course you can.
It's called the Developing Child Centre. It's down in Jamira 1. So the class sizes for Ellis, he's on a school readiness programme. So they work with mainstream schools, but only when the child is ready. The class size is 7. There's 4... the class size is 7, there's 4 teachers. They're very much aware of all issues and challenges, and it's really overwhelming. So when we went to see it, I did cry at everything and everywhere I go. So I cried and I just like, found it so overwhelming, but the staff were brilliant. He loves it. He runs in every day. So that just says, that speaks volumes to me. They do school trips and they do, you know, they have uniform days and PE days. So it's all gearing up. If you looked at it, it would look like a normal school, you know. But they have all of these additional things. They have an OT room. They have therapy rooms. The therapies are also taken into the classroom, which helps them to sort of like take it out of a room and into real life situations.
So how do you tell us about some of the, I guess, the concerns that you're hearing from parents in this particular space as well?
It's an interesting one because I think when people, or maybe parents that have autistic girls and boys, but obviously I speak to mostly with girls, they want their child to be in mainstream school. It's like a goal. How do I get my child into mainstream school? And I think, you know, I was there because Hannah was in a mainstream nursery until FS1. And we tried the LSAs and it just became very apparent that it just wasn't going to work. And I think you have to have a level of acceptance.
Yeah, like self-awareness around it.
You have to have the acceptance as, oh, this isn't going to work. Now, I'm a previous school teacher, so I know the curriculum and I know how it works. And Hannah could not access it. But it's set up for her to fail. Like, the British curriculum is set up for her to fail. And I don't want to put her in that environment where she's always going to be maybe at the bottom of the class or the one that always has to have the additional help and the one that always is different. But it's seen from a negative lens, like less of.
So what have you decided to do with Hannah?
Hannah's with me at home. At first I thought it was homeschooling I was going to do because obviously I've got some teaching skills and I'm quite like a hands-on person. I love doing all the practical playing and all those things. But actually over the past year, I've learnt a term called unschooling and it's a different way to learn. And it's really meeting Hannah where she's at and building up her confidence. So my goal is that she is able to go out to the world with good self-esteem, good confidence in herself, and to explore, like almost like to just adopt a curiosity for her world and to find out what's possible. And that's kind of where I really want to take her, because one of Hannah's, and it's a very common trait in autistic girls, is super high anxiety. I mean, she's born with a high level of anxiety. Like, that to me is heartbreaking. And so for me, I have to a very low demanding approach. And that's a term I've also learned over the past year. So it seems like we're not doing much. Like, from the outside looking in, people might be like, what do you actually do? But those little moments, those small low demand things have helped me see so much progress in a year. it's unbelievable. So that's kind of my advocacy is around that approach.
Heidi, for anyone that's to find out more about some of the methods that you're incorporating with Hannah and, of course, the group as well, what's the best way of getting in touch with you?
Instagram's great. Or come to my coffee morning.
There you go.
Yeah, honestly.
Get a coffee too.
Yeah, come and have a coffee.
Tell you what, if you want to send me the word Heidi, I will send you Heidi's Instagram so you can find out more. Up next, we're going to continue with the text line. We've had a message about sensory processing in a five-year-old daughter. We're marking World Autism Day today with, and I have to say, it's a conversation we have throughout the year, but I think it's really important, especially at this time, to be highlighting awareness, but also acceptance. We've got a trio of brilliant contributors in studio. We've got mum of three, Yasmin Carey. We've got Annabelle Whitcomb from Insight Psychology. She's a speech and language therapist. And Heidi Jones is with us, health coach, her five-year-old. Hannah has been a bit of a fire starter in her world of becoming an advocate for autistic girls, and she's got a support group as well. I wanted to direct this message to you, Heidi. This actually came in yesterday, but we didn't have time for it with Adam, the OT, who says, our daughter is five and has trouble with sensory processing. Any advice on managing sensory overload? School is mostly fine, but weekends, e.g. public places and parties are really challenging us for us all. That's from M.
Well, Hannah has a very high sensory profile. And it's, I would even say it, I'm getting my words wrong here. You never know if it's like going to get better. What I've learned from having an OT and working with Annabelle is that we have to work with Hannah's sensory profile because that's just how she's made up. And so what we've had to do is basically adapt our entire lifestyle to be able to accommodate Hannah. Now, obviously, we're fortunate because we have one child, and so we don't have to consider, you know, a different family unit. But for us, what's helped is, again, really kind of taking into consideration her needs. Now, you have to remember, when you're autistic, you have a hidden disability. So she's never going to be able to help it. Like, this is who she is, and we have to adapt because she has the disability and we're the adults. Mm-hmm. And so if that means me not going somewhere, I don't go. If that means I take her iPad so I can maybe sit and have a coffee somewhere and she can just go in her own little zone, I do that. If it means taking a lunchbox because she won't eat any of the food, you know, we don't go to parties. I don't take her to kids' parties. They don't work. Some people try to accommodate, and that's lovely. But ultimately, I've really just had to take a stand back and look from her perspective and remember that it's a hidden disability. Mm-hmm. It's not something that is just going to go away and be fixed.
I wanted to ask you, I mean, really just make the point that when you've met one autistic child, you've met one autistic child. And we talk about this being a spectrum and a range. So what might work for one family simply might not work for another. And experts, as you know, as Yasmin said, that, you know, you can meet a whole multitude of team and you'll click with somebody but not with another. I wanted to come to you, Annabelle, if you don't mind. We've had a message here. Yeah. Which is from Mel. Mm-hmm. Saying our daughter's three, has been suggested for ASD assessment, speech delay, not responding to her name. She's got words, can make requests for things she needs, but progress has been really slow. But for children with delayed speech who are difficult to engage, potentially ASD, does speech therapy really make a difference? Or assuming they do manage to make progress, would they have eventually got there on their own or progress regardless? I know it's a hard one to answer, but yeah. I'm curious.
It is a big question. Very often when we are working with children and young people with sensory differences, communication differences, there are some underlying, or often, not always, but often some underlying sensory needs. Sometimes those need to be addressed first. Mm-hmm. And that might make a difference, you know, making changes to the environment, which I know when we were talking in the break, both Yasmin and Heidi have done at home. So that's certainly something to look at. In terms of speech and language therapy, I guess we need to kind of look at the priorities here, right? And a lot of people think, oh, it must be that they're talking, but actually that's not really the first step. We have to think about those early interaction skills, that reciprocity, that back and forth. And for us at Insights, you know, we're a very neuroaffirmative clinic. You know, that might start with building those attention skills through their interests and their preferences. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not talking about stereotype behaviors here. We're getting rid of that language. We are talking about special interests, right? And actually doing even more than acceptance. We're moving through appreciation, through empowerment, and eventually we need to level up our autism game to advocacy. That's where we want to go. So next year, let's have autism appreciation day, and we can keep celebrations, and let's keep moving it forward.
I think that's the perfect note to end on. I've had a number of people asking for everybody's details, so if you want to send me the word advocate, let's get that going.
Love it.
On 4001, and I will send you the Instagram, the content details for all of our guests in the studio today. Really appreciate your various insights and perspective. It's been so valuable, and I think a real education, whether you have neurodiverse or neurotypical children. It's a conversation we all need to be part of.
You're listening to Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan, where the number one ingredient is always high-quality salmon, lamb, turkey and chicken.
Lots to talk about over the course of the afternoon. We're taking your questions, and on hand to help is Dr. Manos from Dr. Vet. How are you, Doctor?
Good afternoon. I'm good. Alhamdulillah. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for asking. What's coming into clinic? What's been keeping you busy today?
Same thing. Dogs, cats. This is the most common, let's say, patients that we have.
What about the most unusual animal that has crossed your threshold over the last few weeks or months? Have you had any interesting surprises?
Every day is a new surprise, really. Every day is something different.
I guess that's the part of being a vet, isn't it? You never know what's going to come through the door. Well, we've already had questions about hamsters, about fussy cats, and so much more.
Rabbits.
Yeah,
rabbits. About turtles, parrots, everything. Don't laugh.
No. It's just, I just find it really entertaining to think that you're opening the door every day and you're like, what is going to be waiting for me now? So what we're saying really is there's no such thing as a pet that's too big or too small, or a problem that's too big or too small. We can help you out with it all over the course of the afternoon. I just wanted to ask you, and we're in actually a beautiful kind of time of year weather-wise, and we will be talking about summer properly when it starts to heat up. But in terms of common cases that you're coming through the door, are you seeing anything heat-related yet? And, you know, in terms of preventative care, what do pet owners need to know, Dr. Manos?
Okay, as you said, for the time being, the weather is amazing. I'm walking my dogs early in the morning, and after the sunset, the weather is amazing. They cannot, they walk perfectly fine. They are not panting. They are not struggling to walk. But we know, because all of us we live here in UAE, that after a while, the temperature and the humidity is going to be not pet friendly. So one of the things that I want to make sure is that it's going to be early in the morning, very early in the morning, if we can do it, before the sun is going to start burning everything. And the last walk is going to be late at night. Humidity is going to be high, but at least the temperature is not going to be that, a big knot for them.
We need to change
also,
our routines.
Exactly. Also, don't forget that you just said that you are 173, correct?
Correct.
I'm 178. At the end of the day, the reflecting heat from the pavement, from the tiles, it affects us, but not that much. But when you're walking your dogs outside, and they like chihuahuas or pugs or something, that they have a direct contact with the pavement, the heat that is reflected even during the night is weird. It's very strong. Mm-hmm. Short walks.
Keep it short. Keep it dark and test the ground. You mentioned you've got dogs there. What are your dogs called, Doctor?
I have five.
You got five? Okay. I want to hear them all. Tell me.
Okay. The big one is Bowie. Bowie is a Great Dane.
Oh, wow.
By the way, all of them are adopted here in Dubai. So it's Bowie. It's my first one. He's an old guy. He's 8.5 years old. Then is, now you're going to laugh. I have Yorgos, George, Pagakis. I have Yanis, John Pagakis. I have Bella. These three are also pugs. All of them are pugs. And last but not least, I have Abla, a rescued standard poodle.
I think you're going to need to send me a picture of these guys. I think I need to see a full photo of the clan. Dr. Manos is in the studio today. We're going to come to the text line next. We have got a cat called Boo Boo, who's really fussy to eat wet food, only likes dry. Does it make a difference? And can we convert her? We've had a message saying our three-year-old son pulled our hamster's leg. We think it's now broken. He's not crawling. It's a bit swollen and pink. What could a vet do? Let's see if we can talk little tiny ones after this.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
All about your animals between now and 5 o'clock. We've got Dr. Manas from Dr. Vet on the line.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan, groundbreaking science, life-changing nutrition.
Now, about a year ago, my daughter came back from a play date and she's like, something awful happened. Rosie's sister loved her hamster too hard. And I think, unfortunately, kids squeezing hamsters is quite a common affliction. Dr. Manos, we've had a message here saying, our three-year-old son pulled our hamster from his leg and we suspect it's now broken. He's not crawling as fast and his foot looks swollen and pink. What will a vet do? I don't think they can put a cast on it because it's too tiny. Is this something you've seen in clinic before?
It could happen, but it has to be seen by a vet, an exotic vet. Because if it is broken and there is a fracture, we need to put cast on. The vet is going to tell you the alternative that you have. You cannot leave it like this.
So
the hamster is suffering.
So if it's you, what? Okay, here's, I know it's a kind of an exotics, but in terms of bringing an animal like that in, is it pain relief? Is it sadly having to say goodbye to said hamster, or is there anything that can be done?
Depends what the problem is. If it is fracture, if there is any chance to fix it, we can do it. If there is no chance to fix it, then we're going to decide how and what can approach the problem.
Here's a question I never thought I'd have to ask. How small can you do an x-ray? If you've got a hamster who's, you know, the size of the palm of your hand, do you have an x-ray this big?
Yeah, regardless. It doesn't have to do with the size of the patient, really. You can do whatever you like,
really?
Regardless of the size. Yeah.
There you go. Who knew?
We're taking x-rays from small parrots, for example. And if you see the result, it's amazing. It's huge. You can see all the details.
Wow. No, you need to take this little one, your furry friend, to the vet to see just exactly what is going on, because there might be something that they can do. But yeah, I think this is quite common. If it makes you feel any better, the other hamster in this family got sat on and didn't make it. So fingers crossed, everything will be fine.
Fingers crossed.
Salvador's been in touch, doctor, saying my cat Boo Boo makes a big fuss to eat wet food, only likes dry food. What are the options to make her eat wet food as well? Thank you. Does that actually make a difference in terms of dry versus wet food in cats in particular, doctor?
No difference, really. And from the time that she's eating her dry food, why to change her to the wet food? I don't see the reason why. Cats are very particular animals and very difficult. So if you try to change her from even, saying between dry food, from one protein to another, different taste or a different brand, sometimes they are making a big drama. Mm-hmm. So let her be the way that she likes.
Can I ask about, I guess, the different qualities of wet versus dry food? I mean, I think of dry, and we've talked about this in the past with cats, about being quite good for their dental hygiene as well, for making their jaws work. But are there pros and cons to both?
There is no actual difference, really. Most of the animals, they are just swallowing. There are, on the other hand, dry food pellets that they are made to make them chew, so they could eventually clean the teeth a little bit better, all the dental products. But the majority of dogs and cats, they don't have issues and they are swallowing the food. So for me, either or is the same.
But Salvador doesn't need to worry that his cat's not getting something from the dry food. It's the same.
It's the same. Just the wet food is with water.
Okay.
So from the time that Bubu is eating only dry food, Salvador has to provide her fresh water 24/7.
Perfect. Thank you for that. Hope that helps put your mind at ease, Salvador. Dr. Manas with us today from Dr. Vet. We've had a couple of emotional cat questions that we're going to be coming to. One is about going on holiday. One is about being separated from their sibling as part of what sounds like a divorce. So cat emotions we're going to be tackling as well. We've also had a question about a dog with a jippy belly. KJ saying they've got some diarrhea in the house. I knew it always comes back to toileting on the show.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan.
Joining us on the line now from Dr. Vet in Abu Dhabi. Dr. Manas is here. Dr. Manas, we've had a couple of quite a kind of, I guess, emotional cat questions would be a best way of summarising them. So let's start with this one. It's from Annie, who's listening now, saying, I'm a first-time cat mum for the last 14 months, a failed trap-neuter release. I used to identify as a dog person before, but I'm getting anxious when I've got a trip coming up over Eid. I think about leaving her at home with just someone coming over to feed her. I've got many friends who would do that without any concern, but like everyone else, I think my cat is the most special one in the world. I think it's a bit cruel. Please help. Is it me? Or would she really be sad if I do that? I think that's a really good question with travels coming up, because you have a couple of options. You know, you've got the boarding option and you've got someone coming in, as Annie's talking about, to feed and maybe do a little bit of sensory, mental exercise as well. Do cats get sad when we leave them?
Cats are more attached to the house, not us. So, from my experience, cat sitters, people that they're coming at home, they're feeding them, they stay with them, they play with, a little bit with them, they clean the litter box, the cats are perfectly fine. Boarding facilities, yes, of course. You can also send the cat to the boarding facility, but for me, the cats should stay home, mostly.
That's really interesting. So a cat would be more attached to its home environment and is more disrupted by leaving that rather than the person that they're with necessarily. Out of those two options, you think it's better for someone to come to the home?
If there is a possibility to bring somebody at home, take care of the cat, I want to believe that the cat is going to be happier. On the other hand, there are facilities that they provide services better than home. So the cats are playing there, they feel like at home, but they are not at home. So not to be misunderstood, I would prefer my cat to stay at home if there is somebody that I can trust to feed the cat, clean the litter box. I have done it for friends of mine, but they kept the cats at home and I was going there every day, staying with them after work, before work, to feed them and take care of the cats.
Thank you for that. I think you would obviously be the dream person to have over as a vet. But I think, and obviously anything you can do, Annie, to help ease that adjustment. So, your pheromone sprays or getting them used to the person that's going to be coming in before you go away. Try not to let it overshadow your holiday. You sound like an amazing cat parent. We've also got a new cat parent joining us, listening now, saying our kitten is 2 months old, adopted last week. We're staying in an apartment and he doesn't go out. What is the right age to vaccinate and neuter, and how often should we bathe him? Dr. Manas, let's start with that first one. The right age to vaccinate and neuter male cats.
Starting at the age of 2.5 or less.
2.5 months, just to be clear.
Yeah, just to begin. About neutering male, it's about, depends, 6 months, more or less. Okay, I'm not a fan of castrating young, very young males. Let's say 6 months is not a bad age for neutering.
And second part of that question is, how often should we bathe him? What would you say to that? Will cats kind of get on with it themselves? And it's not like we're in the UK and they're, you know, going out in mud and what my dad would call clart every day. Do you need to bath a cat?
When I came here, I was shocked. When I came to UAE, I was shocked that they are trimming, grooming and bathing the cats. Okay, let it be. Not more often than every 3 weeks, let's say, once a month. But I strongly recommend to brush the cat daily. By brushing, you're going to reduce shedding. And also the fur is going to be shiny and everything is going to be clean.
There you go.
So brushing daily, bath every 3 weeks with animal products, not with human.
And this products, is presumably because the different pH levels, yeah, of skin.
pH levels on the skin, yeah.
All right, really hope that helps. Well done on adopting. We'd love to see a photo. Do send it over on 4001.
This is Pets and Vets on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With ProPlan.
Got time for one last question of a Dr. Manas at Dr. Vet, who's joining us live on the line. It's from KJ saying, my poor dog has got a bit of a jippy belly, which I have to say really made me smile. He's been up three times needing to go outside. We've had him for 5 years. He's never really had diarrhea before. We think it might be because of a new treat he hasn't had before. Not sure what's best to do. Should we fast him for a day, go to chicken and rice, just dry food? Obviously, if it gets worse, we will take him to the vet. KJ, as a human parent, both of my children had gastroenteritis over the weekend, so I'm well used to the jippy belly, but maybe not in canines. What does KJ need to know? We've got about 30 seconds of advice, Dr. Manos.
Go to your vet.
That's simple.
That's it. Okay, most probably it's from the new treat, but should be checked, please.
Okay, because we don't want dehydration. We don't end up like I had on Friday night of a drip of anti-sickness and a drip of, fluids and all that fun stuff. So best to be safe. Dr. Manos, thank you so much for your time today. It was an absolute pleasure to catch up. And you even sent us a picture of your beautiful Great Dane. Bowie was, I can't give you the prize, I'm afraid, but I have to say it was one of the cutest photos we got sent this afternoon. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Wishing you, the team and your five dogs, a wonderful, wonderful week ahead. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.